From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For more than 20 years, ballerina Suzanne Farrell danced with the New York City Ballet. And more than any other dancer, Farrell brought to life the works of choreographer George Balanchine. On this edition of Fresh Air, Farrell talks with us about her relationship with Balanchine on and off stage. Also today, filmmaker James Toback on gambling, rock and roll oldies, sex, and the other obsessions that drive his films. And if your idea of a burning issue is what's the proper way to fold a dinner napkin, commentator Patricia McLaughlin has the perfect magazine for you. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. On the eve of the Superpower Summit, Soviet officials announced that the leaders of the Russian and Kazakh republics had been invited to participate in the proceedings. NPR's Ann Cooper says their inclusion may not change the dynamics of the summit, but symbolically it represents yet another step toward power sharing in the Soviet Union.
It's an acknowledgement from Gorbachev that the republics of the Soviet Union have increasing power, increasing authority. They have demanded economic and political sovereignty, and that means that they want to say in how this country is governed. It also means that they want to be represented at an event like this. I don't know that it has any real impact on, in practical terms, on the final outcome of the summit. But certainly these two republic leaders are going to be in there tomorrow. I'm sure they will have something to say on the many issues on the agenda, including the Middle East and arms control.
NPR's Ann Cooper in Moscow. Russian President Boris Yeltsin signed a treaty today with Lithuania, recognizing the independence of the Baltic Republic. Half the Soviet population lives in Russia, and Lithuanian President Vytautas Landsbergis said today's recognition marks an important step in his republic's struggle for independence. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev has refused to recognize Lithuania or the other Baltic republics as independent states. The fact that the treaty was signed just at the beginning of the superpower summit in Moscow appears to be another move by Boris Yeltsin to assert his republic's authority in foreign policy. The Bank of Credit and Commerce International, under fire around the world, was indicted and fined today by U.S. law enforcement and regulatory officials. In New York, U.S. District Attorney Robert Morgenthau charged BCCI with defrauding investors, while in Washington, the Federal Reserve announced that it's fining BCCI $200 million. NPR's John Idstey reports.
The Federal Reserve says BCCI violated U.S. banking laws when it secretly acquired shares in the parent company of several U.S. financial institutions, including First American Bank in Washington, D.C. The Fed says its action is, quote, based on evidence of secret arrangements that were made between senior officials of BCCI and customers of BCCI, end quote. According to the Fed, the secret arrangements involved BCCI lending money to customers who then bought shares in Credit and Commerce American Holdings, the parent company of First American and other institutions. The customers were paid fees and not required to repay the loans, and BCCI was given authority to sell the shares and the right to any profits. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials gained 13 points to close at 2,985. This is NPR News. South African President F.W. de Klerk today demoted two of his cabinet members who were implicated in covert funding of the Inkatha Freedom Movement. Inkatha's main rival, the African National Congress, had demanded the resignations of Law and Order Minister Adrian Flock and Defense Minister Magnus Malan. Instead, de Klerk put Flock in charge of the Corrections Department and made Malan head of the Housing Ministry. Today, the ANC called for a boycott of all white-owned businesses and scheduled a march in Cape Town tomorrow to protest the secret funding. The anti-abortion group Operation Rescue has been protesting at abortion clinics in Wichita, Kansas for nearly 2 weeks now. Today, federal marshals were called in to keep family planning clinics in the city open. Jenny Golson of member station KMUW in Wichita reports.
U.S. District Judge Patrick Kelly sent letters to the mayor and police chief of Wichita saying that in spite of the mayor's assurances last week that a Wichita abortion clinic would not be blocked, it was blocked by protesters again this morning. And Judge Kelly has ordered U.S. Marshals to intervene. Before the arrival of the marshals at the clinic this morning, nearly 100 protesters were arrested for blocking the gate to the clinic. But the marshals asked for and received compliance from Wichita police in preventing protesters from blocking the clinic entrance. Officials with the U.S. Marshal's Office will not say how many federal law enforcement agents have been called to Wichita to assist in enforcing the restraining order granted by Judge Kelly. For National Public Radio, I'm Jenny Golson in Wichita.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir said today that obstacles to a Mideast peace conference could be cleared away in one more round of discussions with Secretary of State James Baker. At the same time, however, Housing Minister Ariel Sharon announced plans to build thousands of new homes in the West Bank and to expand a West Bank Jewish settlement. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Suzanne Farrell danced with the New York City Ballet for more than 20 years. When she retired from dance 2 years ago, critic Lloyd Schwartz described her as the most beloved dancer of his generation and probably the greatest dancer George Balanchine ever worked with. Balanchine co-founded the New York City Ballet and became one of the century's most original choreographers. Balanchine died in 1983. He was Farrell's mentor and for several years was her closest companion. She writes about their relationship on and off stage in her memoir, Holding On to the Air. I interviewed her last September when her book was published. Farrell was known for her ability to dance with the speed and musicality demanded by Balanchine's difficult ballets. I asked her what she thought were the new contributions she made during her years with the New York City Ballet.
I don't know. I think perhaps the fact that I was not interested in looking the same or capitalizing on a certain particular success that I had had in the past. I was not afraid of falling down and being human and making mistakes. And in fact, that's your laboratory. That's where everything happened, was in the studio. And he was very patient and demanding in the sense that he wanted you to do more so that you could become more what you were really like.
You were one of the first ballet dancers to dance with your hair down. How did that come about?
Well, I was young and I happened to have very long hair, and I think he liked that, and he thought it brought out a femininity, and for the particular ballets that he wanted to do at that time, I guess it was a new look. And also, when I have my hair down, I move differently. It sometimes can act as a veil, or it makes me feel more feminine. Sometimes it has its problems also, but it's quite a different feeling. And I feel more vulnerable when my hair is down.
You had an extraordinary relationship with George Balanchine. When did you first realize that he was singling you out, that he thought that you were a very special dancer and a very special person?
The first ballet he did for me, Meditation, was done in 1963, and I was 18 and he was 59 at the time. And of course I was very flattered and shocked that he had noticed me so much and was interested in doing something. Of course, it's every dancer's dream to have his attention and his love. But then you have to be responsible for what happens, and I had no idea that it would develop into what it did. Of course, there were ballets in between, and I guess it was Don Quixote that really started the intense friendship and affection we had for each other. And it was a ballet that he had wanted to do all his life. He had said that he didn't do it because he was searching for the right person, and he found it in me, and that's a very big honor. And we became close, so close to the point that we didn't know what was on stage, off stage, and things grew in many ways and grew backwards in many ways, and ultimately was pretty difficult. I nearly destroyed me at one time. On the other hand, dancing was our common bond. It was what we both had to do to be happy, and it's what brought us together. And we used to joke. I joked with him that if I weren't a dancer, he wouldn't even look at me. And he joked back and said, well, if I weren't a choreographer, you wouldn't look at me. So we took a long look at each other and started laughing. But no matter how intense things became, I always went back to dancing. We always worked together. It was a sanity and a salvation at the time of great stress.
Suzanne Farrell is my guest, and she's written a new memoir called Holding On to the Air. Let's get back to 1963, when Balanchine was choreographing a dance for you and Jacques d'Amboise, and he wrote a love poem. Balanchine wrote a love poem and sent it to you and wrote, this is how Jacques should feel when he's dancing with you. And there was a P.S. in this note, and it said, I hope by now you are thin and beautiful and light to lift. Let's start with the love letter part, because it was pretty obvious to you that this was a love letter to you, although he said it was meant to describe what Jacques d'Amboise should be feeling. Did you know how to take it then?
No, not really. So because I was so confused, I just took it at face value as a poem about how our abstract characters were supposed to feel towards each other. And that did help in some ways. I had never been in love before, so it was hard for me to know how I would have to dance this ballet. But I guess it all came out in the choreography. And in a way, he choreographed our lives with the format of the ballet, a young girl appearing to an older man and dancing even more passionately as it goes on, and then her disappearing again. It was a very poignant ballet.
You think it was about his feelings for you?
Yes, absolutely. Even to the point where he eventually had Jacques put gray in his hair.
How did you respond to the P.S. of this love poem? The P.S. was, I hope by now you are thin and beautiful and light to lift.
Well, after reading such a beautiful poem, it was certainly a letdown to read it, to find out that that was how he saw me. On the other hand, I suppose he knew more about me than I did at the time, and I was had these sort of baby fat cheeks from playing the clarinet when I was 18, and had to lose that. But I felt terrible that I was not yet what he wanted me to be, so I had to start working on it.
And how did you work on making your cheeks thinner?
I would draw in my cheeks and also try to lose weight. Eventually, it did come off.
One of the things Balanchine has been criticized for was trying to create ballerinas who were so thin that they had to be anorexic in order to stay at the weight that he wanted. Do you think that that was a fair criticism?
Absolutely not. No, he never wanted that. He was a man who liked variety in his dancers, not only in the way they danced, but also in the physical way they looked. And if you go to the New York City Ballet, especially in those days, there were tall, voluptuous girls, there were short, thin girls, there were medium-height girls. Some of the ballets were even characterized as tall girl ballets or short girl ballets. He had roles that he loved women, and he spent his whole life celebrating women and putting them on a pedestal, and he always had different visions of them in his ballets. The Siren in Prodigal Son, she was very voluptuous and seductive, and certainly all the characters I played in Don Quixote were different, and never was there a man who wanted more diverse women to do ballets for than him.
It must have been a very difficult situation in a way when you were in your early 20s, in love with a man in his early 60s who was married, who was also your teacher. And I think when you're like 40 years younger than somebody and they're a master at what they do and they're your teacher, it would be virtually impossible to feel like an equal in the personal relationship. And I'm wondering what effect that had on you.
Well, it was emotionally difficult, but as any performer, any artist will tell you, they're all looking for someone for this type of collaboration. Actresses nowadays don't have anyone writing plays for them. Composers aren't writing operas for singers. this is, you know, practically the only time in this period in the theater where one man was doing all these ballets for one person. It was quite a unique opportunity and something that every performing artist looks for. And you can't make it happen. I think it's chemistry. I think it's fate. I think it's being there at the right time. It's a lot of things that you don't have any control over. And yet it's wonderful when it happens. And the pain, I think, is part of that process. And ultimately, it's worth it in the end.
Were you ever unsure what Balanchine wanted from the relationship with you?
No, I think ultimately he needed to choreograph to be happy to live. He would not talk about himself in terms of being a genius. He believed that God put him here and this is what he was meant to do, and it would not occur to him not to do it. So I think he was very honest and clear that he was meant to work and he needed inspiration.
So you felt that you were his muse in a lot of ways?
He said that, yes. Which is a pretty perilous place to be, especially when when as a young girl you want to work with this man and you want to be everything that he wants in a dancer, and then when suddenly you find that that is what he wants, it's sort of a dream that you're unprepared to live with as a human being.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Suzanne Farrell, who is considered one of the world's great ballerinas. She danced with the New York City Ballet for 18 years, retired from dancing in 1989. She's written a new memoir called Holding On to the Air. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Ballerina Suzanne Farrell is my guest. You were in the position of reading in the Chicago Sun-Times that Balanchine had said that you were engaged, and you knew nothing about this. Did you want to marry?
I wanted to dance at that particular time. I don't know. I don't really know what I wanted at that time. I don't even know if he did. It all got so confusing.
I want to ask you about something an incident that you describe in your memoir, Holding On to the Air. You said that there was a period when Balanchine had been very depressed, and someone in the company had said to you, what's wrong? And you confessed that you weren't going out together. So this person suggested that you start seeing him again. And then a prominent male dancer in the company said to you, why don't you just sleep with him? It doesn't have to mean anything. Is it such a big deal? What was your reaction to that?
I was, of course, shocked. That was just not the way I could live my life. And also, he was married. And I believe our relationship was very much on a spiritual level. He was a very spiritual man. He had to be. You can look at his ballets and see that he felt that he was in service to a higher ideal and to God. And that complicated matters. He, of course, was married.
You ended up getting married to somebody else, to someone who was also a dancer, who was a couple of years younger than you. What were the repercussions when you were married? And I should say that Balanchine had gotten a divorce just 2 weeks before that.
Well, this was a difficult period. I felt that if I continued dancing as well as I could, and that he was still happy with my dancing, that eventually things would all iron out and become good again, because I always wanted to be there for him and to be the dancer that he wanted me to be. But eventually, and quite understandably now when we look back, he didn't want to have Paul in the company anymore and started taking ballets away from him, and... It it became clear that things were not going to get any better. And actually, I'm convinced that it was necessary to leave the company. The only way we ever were to have survived was to separate.
So you were basically, you and your husband were basically exiled from the company. You were around 23, I think, when you left.
Yes.
And you say that you were afraid other companies weren't hiring you. Other companies weren't hiring you, and you say that you think one of the reasons why was that they didn't want to alienate Balanchine because they had Balanchine dances in their repertoire and they wanted more. Do you think that Balanchine would have punished them by withholding new dances had they hired, had one of these companies hired you as a dancer?
I don't really know, but emotions were very high at the time, and no one was acting very noble or sensibly, and it's a possibility. On the other hand, it was after you've had the New York City Ballet and Balanchine, which to me always was and always will be the best place to dance, whether I was a member of the company or not, I never changed my belief in him. It was really best to go to Europe and not stay in America. There was just, everything else was just not as good as I had, and it was time to move on.
How did you get back to the New York City Ballet?
We had been vacationing in upstate New York. We had purchased an island. Strangely enough, after we left the company, it was the most bizarre thing to do because we didn't have a future job in sight, didn't have any money, and things were not looking very good for us at the time in terms of finance and future. But we happened to visit that area, and an island was for sale, and I guess we felt that we just had to have roots somewhere, so we bought it. So then what happened was that we immediately moved to Europe, so we never got there. But during the summers, we would go and visit. And it's only about 2 hours from Saratoga Springs, where the company, New York City Ballet, would have its summer home and were performing. And I was eager to see what had been happening, what new ballets Balanchine had come up with, and to see some of my friends and to sort of just go back to where I had spent my summers in the past as a member of the New York City Ballet. So we went to a performance, and I saw a beautiful ballet, La Valse, which I had done many times before I left the company. And when I got back home, I was so happy to see such good dancing and to see such a beautiful ballet, and it brought back a lot of feelings, a lot of memories. And I just felt compelled to write him a letter and say, Dear George, as wonderful as it is to see your ballets, it's even more wonderful to dance them. Is this impossible? And so it was probably the shortest letter I ever wrote him. And a couple days later, I had a phone call saying that from his secretary saying that Mr. Balanchine would like to see me in New York. So on my way back to Europe, we got together and talked. He opened the door. It was like old times. We hugged each other, and it was basically, well, when do we get back to work? I think we had both changed and were eager and ready to get back to work again.
Was your relationship different when you started dancing with the ballet again?
Not really. We were still comfortable in the studio together. We laughed. I had a great fun re-exploring his repertoires and his training because it was different from where I had come from in Europe. Ballet was always our real heart and soul and center of what our lives were, and it was the air we breathed and our understanding. So it was, in a way, really like coming home.
What about your husband? Did he ever come back? I know he was never hired back by the company, but did he feel comfortable coming over even to pick you up or something?
Oh, sure. He came to the ballet and was happy to see me again. It was a time when we all knew that I was meant to be here, and it was great to be back.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with ballerina Suzanne Farrell, who's written a memoir called Holding On to the Air. You write that when Balanchine died, you wondered if you wanted to dance anymore?
Well, I knew I would not be understood in the same way that Balanchine understood me, and so much of our life was together, and when he died, well, I never thought he would die. I believed in him so much. He used to say he's Georgian, from the Georgian part of Russia, Tbilisi. He said, we live forever. We live to be 100. And he was right in so many other situations, so I thought he would live to be 100. So I was totally unprepared when his health got so bad and it became clear that he was not going to get better. I missed him greatly when he died. I still miss him. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book was because I missed him. It was a way of holding on to him and keeping my sanity. And a lot had been written about us, and I wanted to set the record straight. On the other hand, if I were to run into him on the street now, it would be very normal. I still feel his presence so much. And so I do have him in my life all the time, every time I stage ballets, even in my normal life. He's taught me so much.
You retired from dancing in 1989. How does it feel to not be performing?
I love to dance, and I think maybe one of my problems is that I never got bored with my work. Actually, that's not a problem. It's a privilege. But it did leave me wondering, since my hip operation, what it would be like to live without dancing in my life, and also without music. Music is the main thrust of why I love to dance. And I knew that I would not be able to dance again, but I didn't know if I'd be able to listen to music and not be able to want to dance again. So I started staging ballets, and I went to Leningrad and did Scotch Symphony for the Kirov dancers. And it was an acid test for me because I wasn't quite sure that I would be able to be open with everything I had learned, whether I would wish I were up there dancing, whether I would be able to teach them and get from them what they were meant to give and not impose myself so much. I think it's hard to make the transition, but finally, in the end, I was so fulfilled teaching the ballet to someone. And I guess the tendency often is to pick someone to do your part that looks like you, that you feel you have an affinity for, or you see yourself in. And I was happy that I didn't do that. It was a smaller dancer and different kind of legs, different physique, but she was wonderful, and she wanted to be there. And I was happy that I could tell her everything I know, and we could go on, and I wasn't missing not being on stage. And I felt equally as exhausted or fulfilled sitting in the audience watching them and knowing that they put their trust in what I said and I put my trust in them. It was really wonderful.
Ballerina Suzanne Farrell. Her memoir is called Holding On to the Air. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Filmmaker James Toback isn't afraid to ask the big questions about things like life, death, religion, and sex. That's just what he does in his movie The Big Bang. It's being shown on public TV's POV series next week. Coming up, we get to ask Toback some big questions. Toback is also the director of the feature films Fingers, starring Harvey Keitel, and The Pickup Artist, starring Robert Downey Jr. and Molly Ringwald. And there's a new magazine from that high priestess of the dinner party, Martha Stewart. Commentator Patricia McLaughlin looks over this latest addition to the literature of fashionable housekeeping. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, a grand jury has indicted the scandal-plagued Bank of Credit and Commerce International and two of its founders. They are accused of taking part in a scheme to defraud investors. NPR's Jim Zaroli has more on the story.
The grand jury indicted BCCI and four of its subsidiaries, as well as its founder, Aga Hassan Abadi, and his second-in-command, Saleh Naqvi. The indictment says the bank lured depositors and investors by claiming to have the backing of Middle Eastern oil sheikhs. It also allegedly paid bribes to two Peruvian bank officials to get them to do business with BCCI. New York District Attorney Robert Morgenthau said today that more indictments are imminent.
This indictment spells out the largest bank fraud in world financial history. BCCI was operated as a corrupt criminal organization throughout its entire 19-year history.
In a separate action, the Federal Reserve Board said today it is seeking a $200 million fine against BCCI for violating U.S. banking laws. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
On the eve of Soviet leader Gorbachev's meeting with President Bush, the Russian Republic and breakaway Lithuania signed a friendship treaty. There are also reports of a statement signed by all 15 Soviet republics agreeing to cooperate on all vital economic issues without including the central Soviet government. Gorbachev has gone out of his way to gain the support of leaders of those republics for his campaign to win more Western aid. He announced last week final agreement on a new union treaty, and now a spokesman says that rival Boris Yeltsin, another strong Republic leader, will join in some of the summit talks with President Bush. Israeli Foreign Minister Levy met Egyptian President Mubarak in Cairo this evening. Linda Gradstein reports from Cairo.
Speaking after his meeting with President Mubarak, Foreign Minister Levy seemed more subdued than he usually is. But he said the talks had been warm and friendly and that Mubarak had agreed to renew a dialogue with Israel on the most senior level. This is apparently a reference to Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. Israel has long wanted Egypt to invite Shamir, and it was a hint that if Israel agreed to attend a peace conference, Shamir would be invited to Cairo. But there are still differences between Egypt and Israel over who would represent the Palestinians. That issue was discussed tonight, and the two sides did not reach an agreement. But Levy announced he would hold a second, unscheduled meeting with Mubarak on Wednesday, a sign both men felt there was more to talk about. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Cairo.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 13 points to close at 2,985.24 on volume of 135 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 8-7. This is NPR News. Leaders of the European Community are sending another delegation to Yugoslavia this week after more violence in Croatia over the weekend when dozens of people were killed. In Belgrade, an urgent meeting of government officials has been called for early tomorrow. The EC delegation will try to get a ceasefire in Croatia. In Paris, the Foreign Ministry of France says that it wants the UN to move quickly on easing its embargo against Iraq, so that Baghdad can buy food and medicine for its population. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
Foreign Ministry spokesman Maurice Codeau-Montaigne said France will push the other permanent members of the UN Security Council to agree quickly on easing the embargo so that supplies can reach the Iraqi population. This move is intended to accelerate discussions at the Security Council over a draft resolution on allowing Iraq to export some of its oil. Diplomats in New York have said this resolution would not be ready before the end of August. But France is pushing for an urgent decision following a report last week by a UN aid coordinator in the Gulf. He warned that there's a major risk of a famine in Iraq in the next few months if the embargo is maintained. U.S. President George Bush has responded by saying he doesn't want to hurt the Iraqi people, but he's insisted that a control mechanism must be put in place to ensure that Iraq uses its export revenue to feed its people. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
And the Bush administration plans to sell more weapons to Saudi Arabia, including laser-guided bombs. The Pentagon said today that Congress has been told of plans for a $365 billion weapon sale to Saudi Arabia to become official in 30 days. In the last few weeks, officials have announced plans to sell over $4 billion in weapons to Persian Gulf countries, all of whom were allies during the Persian Gulf War. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest is filmmaker James Toback. His movies and personal life have been the subjects of controversy. His movies for their sex, violence, and sometimes pretentiousness. His personal life for his alleged womanizing. Film critic David Thompson described Toback's film Fingers as one of the most intense American pictures of the 70s. Thompson described Toback as having an unnerving mixture of tyranny and sensitivity. Toback also wrote the screenplay for The Gambler and wrote and directed Exposed and The Pickup Artist. His latest film is a personal documentary called The Big Bang. I spoke with Toback last year when The Big Bang first opened in theaters. It will be shown next week on PBS as part of the POV series. For The Big Bang, Toback gathered together a collection of friends and acquaintances, including basketball star Daryl Dawkins, writer Veronica Gang, jazz composer Julius Hempel, and violinist Eugene Fodor. And Toback interviewed them about such intimate subjects as sex, religion, death, and family. I asked Toback if the camera gave him the license to ask such intimate questions, or if he could have asked those questions anyway.
I'm brazen in the way I ask questions of everybody. I have made a habit of asking whomever I've been with whatever has been on my mind since I can remember. And it has endeared me and gotten me very close to a lot of people very deeply and very fast, and antagonized a number of people who are horrified, enraged, and even hateful sometimes because of it. It's a very insinuating and challenging way of approaching the world, and it works in my favor and it works against me, but I have found that when it works in my favor, it's with people that I really wanted to get to know, and when it works against me, it sort of serves as a litmus test to eliminate those people that I wouldn't have had all that much to do with anyway.
Now, you tell the producer on film that when he is dead, this is the one thing he's going to be remembered for, producing your movie. It takes a lot of arrogance to make a statement like that. Does it take arrogance to make a movie?
Well, absolutely. It's a huge claim on the cosmos. I mean, what you're really saying is, I, among the 5 billion people on Earth, have a vision, a story, an idea, a group of people, a film, sound that I want to penetrate the consciousness of the planet with and have in a box on shelves all over after I'm dead. And, of course, the obvious response to that on the part of the other 4.999 billion people is, so what? We all do. And there is, on a democratic level, no real answer to that challenge. But finally, one has to make one's own claim to justification on Earth, or else what's the point in continuing to exist? And mine is that what I'm going to come up with is going to interest and fascinate and engage at least some people. I don't claim to be a mass popular entertainer, and I therefore would never be asking for a huge amount of money to make a movie because it wouldn't make sense. But within the limited realm that I feel I can work well in, I do feel a confidence that I think is justified.
I think most of your movies are about subjects that obsess you: romantic love, sex, music, gambling. Do you need to be obsessed before making a movie, obsessed by the subject?
Absolutely. I would be a mediocre director at best in material that came, probably that came from somebody else, period. Certainly that came from somebody else that didn't really engage me totally, because I didn't come to movies out of experience, craftsmanship, education. I came to it by instinct, compulsion, and urge. To go about filmmaking in the normal way, that is to say by training, by experience, by experiment, technically, is something where I come up very short, and I would feel I was swimming in the wrong pool.
Your 1978 movie, Fingers, starred Harvey Keitel as a young classical pianist who also collects on his mobster father's debts, and he collects using his gun and using his fists. So he's part artist and part gangster. Do you see yourself as being part both, too?
Well, I don't qualify as a gangster, fortunately. I think that I have had a lot of associations through the years because of, let's say, problems I've created for myself through various obsessions that have brought me in touch with people. But contact with gangsters is all one needs to show one that one is certainly not a gangster. I mean, it's a very special world, and one that I would find it probably unbearable to live in as a main way of life. I think as a kind of fringe life, there's a certain intrigue. People who are flaunting death all the time and breaking the law, but it's not something I would want to live myself. Being an artist or thinking of myself as an artist is something that's hard to say. It's you start to take yourself a lot more seriously than you should when you think of yourself that way. What I do think is that I found a way of expressing things that I always wanted to express through film. I tried it as a musician. I tried it as a novelist. I tried it as a journalist. I tried it as a short story writer, as a poet, and didn't feel that I was close to expressing any of it adequately in any of those forums. So fortunately, I found film where I do feel that there is some chance of getting through.
Well, let me ask you about another movie. The Gambler had your screenplay, and it starred James Caan as a compulsive gambler.
Right.
Now, you've been a gambler yourself. I don't know if you still gamble or not, but
I try not to.
Uh-huh. How did you start gambling?
It's an interesting question. I guess I started with a dreidel when I was 5 years old. There's something strange about gambling in the Jewish tradition. There's an inordinately high percentage of Jewish gamblers in America, and also an inordinately high percentage of guilty Jewish gamblers. The percentage of gamblers in Gamblers Anonymous who are Jewish is obscenely high. You sometimes feel you're at a Seder. And I don't quite know why that is, but I think I did start with a dreidel and then with baseball cards, and so that before I was 11, without ever having bet more than a quarter on anything, I probably would have qualified as a compulsive gambler. And then once I started visiting casinos and reading Dostoevsky, the two things became intermingled, and it was very tough not to get going with it.
Wait. What's the connection of Dostoevsky to your gambling?
Well, Dostoevsky was the seminal literary, psychological, religious, emotional, philosophical influence on my life. I had read just about every word he'd written by the time I was 15 and was rather foolishly enacting the more bizarre characters' behavior in his novels. I mean, Rogoshin's mad passionate love. When I was 14, I was going around carving threatening messages on girls' doors when they weren't responding properly. So, I mean, I could have gotten into a lot of trouble through Dostoevsky. And one of the things that happened was I got so chemically... with a chemical inclination towards gambling anyway, I got so hooked into his obsession with gambling, both as an individual, reading about him, and the way he wrote about it in his novels, that no sooner did I have a casino available to me that I felt I was in my milieu.
Another passion of yours you've already mentioned, which is music. And you seem to be particularly obsessed from your movies with oldies from the 50s. What are some of the musical extremes you've gone to?
Well, I was a regular on the Alan Freed Rock and Roll Party.
Oh, no, really?
I sure
as a
was.
Dancer?
As a dancer,
oh,
yeah.
No.
When he was on from 4 to 5 on Channel 5, 5 days a week, I used to do it in the summers. And I always loved all of Alan Freed's whole rock and roll family. And actually, there's a line in Fingers where Harvey Keitel, who's playing loudly on his tape, Summertime, Summertime by the Jamies,
yes.
says to a guy who's angry at him for playing it loud in the restaurant, this is the most musically inventive song of 1958. And it was.
So do you still dance?
No. I mean, I got to lose weight. I gained weight. I used to be really thin. I got to lose 35 pounds, then I'll start dancing again. It's terrible. Jackie Gleason was the only great overweight dancer in history. And I got to get back down to 155 before I dance.
My guest is screenwriter and director James Toback. His movies include Fingers, Exposed, The Pickup Artist, and The Gambler. His documentary, The Big Bang, will be shown next week on public TV. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Filmmaker James Toback is my guest.
Another movie that you made, and this is one of your more recent ones, is called The Pickup Artist. And it's about someone who's obsessed with picking up young women and is always trying out new lines on them and using time-tested ones as well. And I think this gets to another obsession of yours, which is sex. And there were rumors that Pickup Artist was based on your own habit of picking up women. And there was also a Spy magazine article about a year ago that said that you've approached many women on the street, shown them your director's card, and invited them to have sex. I can't speak to the credibility of any of this, but for me, you know, like reading this article about you and mm-hmm. having seen your movies, let me tell you what it made me think about.
Right.
I've seen Pickup Artist and Fingers, and I like both films very much. They're both in part about sexual obsession. One gets at it through a very kind of bleak drama. And the other gets at it through a much more lightweight kind of romantic comedy, but they're both really fascinating films. And this kind of obsession that I really thought was very convincing, very interesting on film, kind of scares me in real life. Do you know what I mean? It's not something I'd want to contend with in real life, though as art, I find it really interesting subject matter. And it made me think about the differences between art and life.
Well, that I mean, I think that that's true of almost all separations, and they're very delicate. I think one of the people, one of the reasons people become artists is precisely, to avoid needing to do the things that they want to write about and feel compelled to write about. I mean, if someone, for instance, writes about, like this movie Henry, these guys
making the portrait of a serial killer.
Yeah, they felt compelled to make a movie about a serial killer. Now, I don't know them personally, and I don't know whether they're closet serial killers, but I do know that you don't make a movie about a serial killer as well as that one is done unless you have some real interest in it and unless you'd prefer to make a movie about it rather than do it. Let me just say, because you brought it up in relation to the Spy article, that that particular article was a complete series of lies and inventions. The people always say, well, why don't you sue if it's not true? You literally cannot win a libel suit unless it is so blatant and so outrageous and so conscious. The law in America is totally stacked against, which is what Spy thrives on and lives on.
You mentioned Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, as an example of a film about mass murder that was probably not made by a mass murderer, but of someone who had some
inclination towards it.
Uh-huh. Now, I mean, I guess the difference is like in your movies, it seems most of your movies, your obsessions that are on screen are obsessions you've actually acted out in real life.
Well, no. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Some yes, some absolutely not. I mean, the more violent aspects of the films, the violent aspects of Fingers, collecting, killing, blowing people's heads off, these are not things that have been part of my life. I mean, I know enough about them and have been around them enough to write legitimately about them. But there's been a tremendous amount of displacement. I mean, I gamble, but I don't. When I was teaching, I was not, you know, getting a student to dump games, which is what Jimmy Kahn does in The Gambler. And there's a danger when there is enough autobiographical similarity in thinking that it's full autobiography. And in the case of The Pickup Artist, the guy was 21 years old, which unfortunately right now is less than half my own age. And I was making fun of the character. I mean, The Pickup Artist is not a straight film. It's a comedy. It takes sexual obsession and romantic obsession and treats them in a kind of playfully mocking way.
Hmm. In your movie Exposed,
yeah,
you had a role in the beginning as a very intense, very pretentious, sexually manipulative professor.
Yeah.
And in the lecture that you're giving to your class in the opening of the movie, you say, the Western world is breaking down socially, politically, economically, morally, aesthetically, psychologically. There's only two routes for escape, art and romantic love.
Now, see, there's a perfect example of what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
I'm glad you thought of it, because I wouldn't have. But I took a character and made fun of him and played him and made fun of myself and at the same time share some of the views that that character has. I mean, it's very clear to me that that character in the scene with Nastasia, whom he's living with at the time and she's getting rid of him, is a lout. And I have no objection to playing a lout as an actor. I have no objection to seeing the world from everybody's point of view, including the point of view of a lout, or else you can't write. If you're going to write just from a kind of journalist point of view or essayist point of view, then you should be an essayist, not a filmmaker. But the Western world is breaking down notion is, in fact, something that I at least see every side of. I share to a degree.
Can I ask you a couple of questions that you ask people who you interview in The Big Bang?
Absolutely.
Are you afraid of death?
No, I'm eager for it.
Eager
I mean,
for
yeah,
it?
I gotta watch out. I mean, I am absolutely fascinated by the idea of dying and by knowing that I have to die and by the whole mystery of what it is or isn't, and anything that you, I mean, even going to a doctor that you know you have to go to see or have an operation, there's a perverse fascination in actually doing something that you know you're going to have to do. And since death is the only thing you really know you're going to have to do, I think it's almost irresistibly intriguing. And I was always curious, interested in about suicide from the time I can remember, simply because, not out of depression, but simply because of being fascinated by death and what it is. And the three or four times I've come close to dying and really thought I was going to die, I was always exhilarated, never afraid.
Do you think that leads to self-destructive behavior?
It may. I mean, I'm not aware of it. Let's put it this way. When you go for a swim and the undertow is strong and you're swimming straight out and you realize you might not be able to get back unless you turn back right then, but you enjoy the sunset you're swimming into, so you continue swimming out another 100 yards without looking back, one could question your reasons more than just pleasure in swimming.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
James Toback's documentary, The Big Bang, will be shown on most public TV stations next Tuesday as part of the series POV. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what's the latest story you have on the BCCI?
The Bank of Credit and Commerce officials were indicted today in New York, Terry. We'll have a report on that and also talk to the Senate investigator who's uncovered a lot of the evidence which has led to these indictments. We'll have a report from Ann Cooper in Moscow on President Gorbachev as he faces a summit with trouble to the left of him and trouble to the right of him. The European community is trying again to bring peace to Yugoslavia. And we have a report from Katie Davis in Mexico on A Town of Women.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Thanks to the recession, the magazine business is in a deep slump. Ad pages way down, books biting the dust left and right. But in all the gloom, there's one ray of sunshine. Time Warner announced earlier this month that test issues of a new magazine called Martha Stewart Living had sold so well on newsstands that it will be published on a regular bi-monthly schedule beginning this month. But commentator Patricia McLaughlin probably won't subscribe.
In case you've never heard of her, Martha Stewart is a former caterer whose mission in life is to make our lives, pardon me, our lifestyles, comfier, cozier, and more elegant. She lectures, she writes books, she's on the Today Show. She designs sheets and tablecloths for Kmart. She has a dinner music series on CD and cassette, and now she has this magazine. I bought it yesterday. The first thing I noticed is that, even though the theme is summer, nobody in it looks hot. Not only are the people in this magazine cooler than I am, they're having a lot more fun this summer. doing neat stuff like gigging for flounder by torchlight, grilling shrimp on the beach, making gorgeous bouquets of roses, frosting wedding cakes, eating homemade ice cream, sailing, turning cozy old farmhouses into bed and breakfasts. Nobody in this magazine is actually doing embroidery, but it does include, as a special gift from Martha, an iron-on transfer that I could use to create an authentic reproduction of a charming antique toss pillow, satin-stitched with pansies in the legend, "Think of Me." Except that I don't know how to do the satin stitch. Who does? My grandmothers could do all this stuff. Embroider, crochet, turn French seams, put up piccalilli. I never learned. Those things seem dispensable, frivolous. No, I'm not so sure. I think we really lost something when the fine arts of housekeeping disappeared from our lives. It's that sense of loss that creates a market for magazines like this. But even if we knew how to do this stuff, who has time? I feel like I'm doing well if once a month or so I knock the spider webs off the legs and stretchers of the dining room chairs. Of course, the spiders just spin more. The fact is, they use that dining room more than we do. I should probably just let them have it. I'm not alone here, right? I mean, I'm sure there are people who are going to make Martha's pink and white gazpacho and paella and grilled vegetables and serve it all on a tablecloth they hand-painted with whimsical sea creatures under an organdy tent on the beach lit with teensy white lights. They're going to embroider the pansies and strip and refinish their porch floors in the checkerboard pattern and plant the antique roses and buy several of the charming $700 wicker chairs. But there can't be more than 6 or 8 of these people, can there? I mean, this isn't stuff you can do on your lunch hour or while your kids are taking their naps. This is full time. So what about the magazine's 350,000 other readers? My theory is that for most of them, Martha Stewart Living is a kind of pornography of wicker and chintz. It's to housekeeping what Playboy is to sex. They're not going to actually do this stuff. I mean, who's going to spend $700 for a porch chair when you can get these nice white plastic ones for $6.97 at your local discount store? But they like to flip through the magazine and ogle the nice old Adirondack chairs and salivate over the fancy menus and wonder if those pretty homemade sundresses are as easy as they look. And just daydream. Just think how nice it would be to live that perfect Martha Stewart life, if only they ever had the time, or the money, or the energy.
Patricia McLaughlin is a syndicated columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer magazine. You can share your thoughts about Fresh Air with us by calling our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Verblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
And now it's springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Only one filmmaker could create a production number as tasteless and funny as Springtime for Hitler. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with Mel Brooks.
Marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the